Three, two, one.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 20s in 20 podcast, where we cover everything you need to know about your 20s in only 20 minutes. I'm Mallory Metz, and this is As Good As It Gets.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to another episode of 20s in 20. I'm Mallory Metz, and today I'm so excited for our guest. In our virtual studio today, we have Taylor Reichelt. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
So excited to have you on. I think today's topic is an important one, and I'm really excited to hear it from your perspective, get your advice, suggestions. But first and foremost, why don't you go ahead, introduce yourself, tell us, you know, a little bit about who you are, where you live, your age, all that good stuff.
So again, my name is Taylor Reichelt. I'm originally from Los Angeles, California, currently living in Orange County. I'm 32, and I am a lot of things. I don't like to define myself as one, but I'm a husband, I'm a son, I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic, I'm an outdoor enthusiast, I am a person who tries to make impact and spread as much knowledge as I possibly can.
It sounds like you wear a lot of hats. We love that. Can't just fit one person into a square.
Totally.
But today's topic, you know, you and I had a little bit of a previous conversation about what this would be like. So I'm really excited to talk through today's topic. And it's really about sobriety, finding your sobriety, helping others find their sobriety, what it's been like, life after, and so much more. So I guess to give a little bit of background to get this started, I would love to get some background on what led to your sobriety. And I don't know if you have like a story you want to lead in with, or if we just need to go right into like, when did you determine that you needed to become sober? Would love to just get a little bit of background.
Totally. I always think some context is important. Unfortunately, drug addicts and, you know, alcoholics have a stigma surrounding them. Mm-hmm. And it's always like, oh, well, your parents must have been horrible, or, oh, you, you know, just decided to one day wake up and do heroin and you're a terrible person, right? So I think some context is always, always important in stories like mine. I had a great childhood. You know, my parents did everything right. We had an extremely loving and compassionate home. We had everything that we needed, everything that we wanted the majority of the time. They were really strict on values and morals and being honest. But there was something about me. I had something missing within me. I could always communicate with my parents openly, or at least they told me that I could, and they put in the action that I could, but I never did. I never felt like I could. Mm-hmm. I had a lack of identity growing up. I didn't know who I was. I had a hard time connecting with other people. I had an extreme fear of the unknown, an extreme fear of the world. At the time, I didn't notice all this, but I was able to process all this after. If I had known it at the time, I think I may have taken another road. But in school, I had friends, but I always thought they were talking about me when I walked away. I had this extreme insecurity about myself and this hole inside of me. And it was hard for me to connect with certain groups. Right? It was really difficult to connect with the athletes. You know, at that age, it's like you had to like innately be good at sports. It was really hard for me to connect with the popular kids because I didn't feel like I belonged or had anything in common. It was really hard for me to connect with the quote unquote geeks, you know, because I didn't spend a lot of time trying to learn a lot of stuff, or not a lot of things interested me at that point. But something happened when I approached the burnouts or the stoners or the drug addicts at that point. All I had to do was do drugs and I was in. Yeah, I was in. It was a no-brainer. You know, so that connection, that identity was the turn in my life right there. I embodied that. I decided this is what I'm going to be. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Eventually, that led me to waking up at the age of 27, strung out heroin, meth, crack cocaine, spending the majority of my life on bathroom floors. I don't mean to be graphic, but covered in dried blood, looking for veins, my limbs swollen, and basically waiting to die. I had convinced myself at that point that I was born to die a drug addict, and that my life was supposed to be an example of how not to live yours. And I thought they were gonna find me dead in a bathroom of a fast food restaurant like a lot of my friends.
Ugh, that breaks my heart, Taylor.
There's a good ending to the story.
Yeah, I'm like, and then? At what point were you like, okay, this doesn't have to be my life. I'm gonna make a change. Was this like self-induced? Was this external from friends and family? Like, what caused that change?
I tried the self-induced aspect at one point. My family did everything they possibly could, and they did everything right. You know, it's just such a hard line between loving and enabling and trying your hardest and tough love and giving you everything and taking everything away. It's impossible, you know, to find that line there. So they did everything they possibly could, especially in the end, to protect themselves, because with friends and family and loved ones, at the end of the day, we need to protect ourselves if our loved one is in drug addiction. I spent a lot of time wondering this myself. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what was it that allowed me or enabled me to get sober when I did? You know, I used to describe it as like taking an Advil for a headache. You don't really know when the headache goes away. You just realize like, oh, I don't have a headache anymore. That's kind of how I used to describe it. And I really dissected it for a long time. But for me, I happened to be in the right place at the right time with just enough willingness, and the right people said the right things to me. It's kind of this perfect storm of compassion, understanding, me just being exhausted, being tired of the consequences, and being treated like everybody else. I went to rehab one more time. What I thought at that point was just to lick my wounds and save up some money, but somebody there called me cool, which I remember just losing my mind because I hadn't been called cool ever, if not in many, many years. And they told me they liked being around me. And this person knew nothing about me except for the fact that I was a drug addict. That's all they knew about me, and they still accepted me. And instantly, I was a part of a community again. And all I had to do was not get high. And I had identity. I was, at that point, sober Taylor rather than drug addict Taylor. And that connection to these people that knew nothing about me and showed me love and compassion, accepted me for who I was, and allowed me to be part of a community again. And on top of that, told me that I could help other people just by staying sober. That was the turning point for me.
Yeah, that allowed you to become who you are today. I would love to give the listeners some insight into what is it actually like getting sober? What was your experience like in these rehab facilities? And then how is it coming out of that? And then entering the real world.
That dynamic is difficult. I came from a place of doing anything I wanted, whenever I wanted, with no accountability to anybody, not even myself, right? And then I'm thrown into this environment where people are telling me to do everything. And they're telling me, you know, when to wake up, when to eat, you know, do chores, to make it to the van on certain times, to be in this group at this time. And I struggled with that in the beginning. I struggled with that because I started fighting it. But once I made the decision to stay sober, and I think that's one of the most important parts, we need to make a conscious decision that, hey, I'm going to change my life. Even if it's just for like split second, if I just say this in this moment, I want to change my life, then it gives me the ability to accept what these people have to offer. In the rehab facilities, these are the professionals. I'm entrusting them to help me make a change. And the second I allowed them to start doing that, everything changed for me. So when I stopped fighting them and I said, here, just take control, when I surrendered completely to them and their program, that's when I started to see change in my life. And I think that's really important for people to understand. If they get into a rehab facility, they need to accept the help, even if for a moment, because once they do, then the change will start to happen. Because obviously we can't do things on our own. Our habits and our patterns brought us to the rehab, and you know, they won't serve us any longer once we're there. It'll just hinder our growth. Once I was into that environment though, and I acclimated to it and I started using the tools that they gave me, it was hard to leave. It was hard to leave. I was terrified of the outside world. I was safe here. I was doing good here. I was making progress here. I didn't know anybody on the outside world that didn't get loaded, you know, besides my family. And I didn't really have a connection to them at that point. So what I started to do was practice for real life, a controlled reality, if you will. You know, I got to the part of the rehab where they let me get a job and gave me some more freedom. And I started to venture out. And for me, the 12-step program, that's what allowed me to be in a social setting, that allowed me to, you know, practice my communication skills and allowed me to help with my social anxiety. That's where I found a lot of practice, was in the 12-step rooms. I mean, they also offered the program of AA, which is great. For me, it worked, still works. So I think that's important, getting some type of community outside of the rehab before you leave the rehab, whether it's church, whether it's a 12-step program, whether it's a nonprofit that does service for other people on a regular basis, just some type of community that has a goal that you would like to achieve, you know, and gets you into a group of people that are on a similar, if not the same path as you. Because if I don't have that when I leave rehab and I just go right out into the open world, I'm gonna get eaten alive. Yeah. If I'm completely on my own out there, I'm not gonna survive. So I think that's really important. So acclimating back into to the real world with some type of community is extremely important. And for me, again, that was a 12-step program.
To maybe shed some light on your rainbow at the end of the tunnel is, first of all, how long have you now been in recovery? And then how has your life changed coming out of that? I know you've got a strong social media platform. That's how I found you. That's how you're here today. And then I know you've also made a lot of big life changes. You're married now. You've got an independent lifestyle. So would love to hear about, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel.
It blows my mind. Honestly, if I take a step back and look at my life on paper, it's one that I never thought possible, never thought that I wanted, never thought that I deserved, but it's beyond my wildest dreams, honestly. I'm 5 years sober now. October was 5 years. So my sobriety date is October 10th, 2015. I am, like you said, I'm married in the most healthy relationship I've ever been in. You know, when drugs and alcohol are the center of a relationship, love and compassion and understanding just don't survive. Unfortunately, it's not possible in my experience, at least, you know. So being able to communicate transparently, have empathy for the other person, come to a realization that it's not all about me, be there in times of need, support in any situation, those are skills that I learned in sobriety. How to be the best husband and partner that I can be. And one of the biggest gifts for me is the ability to help other people through my hobbies and through my very impulsive learning. Once I got sober, I went on this quest to learn absolutely everything about the world because I missed so much of it, you know? It's a very irrational goal because clearly we can't know everything. And the second we think we do know everything, we know nothing. It's, you know, of course, the paradox. But my hobbies, skydiving, surfing, rock climbing, hiking, I think those are how I connect to the world now. All of those include my spirituality, my connection to the universe. And they allow me to help other people. They allow me to say, hey, man, I'm doing this really cool thing and you're new in sobriety and you might think it's boring or you might not understand what you want to do or what your passions might be, but let's go try this, you know? And if you don't like it, it's cool. Let's go do this. Learning who I am and what I like and what I don't like are really important early in sobriety, you know? And we have to be intentional about that stuff. We can't just kind of coast through early sobriety thinking that, you know, the heavens are just going to open up and people are just going to hand us $1 million and we're going to get these loving and amazing relationships out of nowhere. Like, no, we're just sober. Like, this is what we should be. We start at the baseline of life at that point. Yes, it's phenomenal that we're not doing drugs and destroying, you know, ourselves and the relationships around us anymore. Yeah, but okay, like, now what, right? And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that you need to, you know, build a $1 million business out of a month sober or have everything figured out at all. If just not doing drugs is all that an individual can handle in that early time of sobriety, great, then focus on that. But I really urge people to understand that there is so much more. Sobriety allows us to live. It is the catalyst for us being able to discover what life is truly about.
Yeah, and I think that's important regardless of who you are, regardless of what your lifestyle is like. Get out there and try things and do things and don't just like sit and do the same routine every day regardless of who you are, is my personal opinion.
Same.
But moving into sort of, I guess, what we will call the next chapter of this podcast, I would love to talk through just some of your general advice or thoughts on some questions I put together. The first one being, you know, this podcast is all about being in your early 20s. How do you recommend people going about helping a friend who they know is struggling with addiction? I think, especially when you're in your mid to early 20s, this is a hard time where you're coming out of college where it was quote unquote acceptable to be doing these like binge drinking behaviors.
Totally.
And then when is it appropriate to start having this conversation of like, hey, I'm concerned about you and the lifestyle you're living, and how do you go about that?
So it's extremely important that we have that conversation in a very understanding context, right? We're not blaming the individual. We're not, you know, saying, hey, you did this, or hey, you should do this. We're simply asking, hey, is everything okay? Do you think that you might need some help, right? Is there anything that I can do to support you as a friend? You know, because a lot of the time, as I know very well in the work that I've done and in myself, if somebody tries to give me advice like, hey, you should do this, you should get sober, you should stop drinking, that's just not only going to push me farther into what I'm doing, but it's also going to cut me off from any type of help in that individual. You know, and it's a disservice that we do to these people that may need support, because if I'm somebody that they trust and then with me approaching it in the wrong way, they cut me off, it cuts them off from a lifeline and a line of support. So it's really important that we just go into this with an extremely understanding, compassionate viewpoint and almost tactical way, if you will. And it's not one conversation. It's not. This is a continual conversation. I mean, I'm a firm believer that drug addiction, especially with what's going on nowadays and the drugs and the state of the world with the loneliness and the depression and the extreme mental illness, like drug addiction should be taught in school. You know, the same way as English and math is taught, like it should be taught because it's that important. So it's a continual conversation. It's checking in. It's just letting them know like, hey, I'm here for you. Not you're drinking too much, right? Hey, I'm here for you if you ever need support. Because if we come at it from that angle, eventually they will reach out. You know, sometimes they won't and we can't have an expectation. I think that's really important too. Yeah. We cannot have an expectation for what they should do, how they should respond. The same way we can't have an expectation for anybody and how they live their life. When they come and ask, hey, you know, I think I need help, then we can start to help them look for resources. And if an individual knows somebody that's struggling, I urge them to start doing research on their end. So when that person does come for you, you have it ready for them.
That makes a lot of sense. And do you feel like that advice changes when you're trying to support a friend who's already in recovery? Like, so someone who's already taking the steps to get clean or sober, do you feel like your advice stays the same or do you feel like it changes a little bit based on where they are?
The majority of it's the same, right? Have a loving and compassionate understanding of what they're going through. Mm-hmm. If they're already in sobriety, I suggest people, they celebrate the small victories. I think it's important for somebody that was in early sobriety to get that recognition, to get that validation that, hey, I'm on the right track.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a great segue into my next question, which is really, you know, you've acted as a mentor to others. You use your social platform to really help guide and teach others. And so what has been the biggest learning since helping others go through recovery? What have you learned from that? And what has it been like sort of being on the outside looking in a little bit?
The biggest thing that I've learned is there is not one size fits all for treatment and recovery. I wish there was. We'd have a lot more success. It's a process of trial and error. My favorite thing about recovery, my absolute favorite thing, is the complete and utter transformation of the individual. Mm-hmm. Body, mind, spirit, life, relationships, hobbies, like I mentioned in the past, like all of it. This person goes from an absolutely helpless, self-seeking, selfish person to one of the most incredible people this world has ever known. Like, I've seen it over and over again. But the truth is that just it's the exception instead of the rule.
Taylor, I end every podcast episode talking about pet peeves relative to the subject we've been talking about. Obviously, this one's a little bit harder, but maybe some pet peeves either around like the stigmas around sobriety or even like the journey to sobriety. Would love to hear your thoughts.
I read this in your email and I thought about it and two came to mind. And I'm going to mention these, but I know from the deepest part of my heart, there is no ill intention behind these.
Right.
Okay. But if you have a friend or a loved one that is in sobriety, maybe avoid doing these two things, right?
Okay.
Because they're just kind of annoying. When somebody offers me a drink and somebody around says he can't have that because he's sober. If he drinks that, he's going to do heroin. My response is I can have it. I choose not to. But yes, they're right. You know, if I drink, because then everybody wants to know about that and what's going on. And it just kind of puts a spotlight on me. And then another thing I think people need to be conscious about for themselves is when somebody is overly apologetic because they're drinking in front of me. I'm so sorry. Or they're talking about this great whiskey they had last night. And oh my God, I forgot you were there. I'm so sorry. You know, and it's like, dude, it's okay. Like, this is my lifestyle. I do not expect everybody to conform to my lifestyle. You know, if I was allergic to peanut butter, you wouldn't be apologizing because you had a peanut butter sandwich last night. You know, it's those two things. And again, there's no ill intention, you know, but it's just kind of like, it goes with the stigma. And I'm sure there's a whole backstory behind it that we could get into. But those are just the two things that I thought about. And they're not that big of a deal. Sometimes it presents an opportunity to educate and, you know, help somebody. But those are just like the two little things that irk me sometimes.
I think that's great. I think it's the same thing about, you think when people are dieting or working out, it's like, yes, I wouldn't expect you to do the same thing I'm doing. So it's fine. Totally. Okay, Taylor, well, that's all I had for today, but just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on, you know, making this work. This was really great.
Absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for everything that you're doing to make an impact and help others.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, go to our Instagram, follow us, give us a like, give us a shout out, tell your mom, tell your grandma, and leave us a comment. Thanks for joining us.